I'm Carl Smith. Elmer Street, the North Side continues. Welcome back to Elmer Street, the North Side, the 1950-era story of a group of African Americans in the city of South Bend, Indiana, who formed a co-op shrouded in secrecy, challenging the systems of racism to fulfill their dreams of owning homes. During their first meeting, the group elected a slate of officers. Loretha Allen became the president, Earl Thompson vice president. The secretary was Louise Taylor and Ruby Page as assistant secretary. The treasurer was Bland Jackson. All men worked at the Studebaker factory, and four out of the five officers were next-door neighbors on Prairie Avenue. The group's attorney, Chester Allen. He was one of the major actors in this endeavor. He told members of the group that he already had a location for building the homes in mind, though nothing specific was said. The overtones of the meeting were not unlike the gatherings in the South, where strategies were formulated to combat racism. Gatherings held at the risk of bodily harm. The air of secrecy hung thick over each meeting. Attorney Allen did not have to spell out the reason for the secrecy. Everyone in the room was all too aware of the precariousness of the situation. Those present had plenty experience with discrimination in all aspects of their lives, at work, in housing, in their leisure activities. While discrimination in the North was not legalized as in the South, it was still publicly sanctioned and ubiquitous. Attorney Allen wanted them to move quickly and secure the site before anyone was alerted to African Americans moving into a white neighborhood. He stressed the importance of acting as a corporation, receiving its corporate charter, and the need to keep good records. Once the charter was received, the lots could be purchased and the loans secured. Only after all that was settled would the individual homeowners pursue their own mortgages. Secrecy. Again and again throughout the first meeting and emphasized at subsequent meetings, the need for all their discussions and negotiations to be kept secret. Attorney Allen insisted repeatedly, no information should be given out. The North was to be a field of dreams. However, discrimination was alive and well. One quote from the book stands out. Hardy Blake, a Studebaker worker from Mississippi, stated, quote, "I left the South to get away from Jim Crow, and then I met Jim Crow in the North," close quote. Reverend Buford Gordon was the first minister for a chapel that was to become a part of Olivet AME Church. His book, The Negro in South Bend, a Social Study, examined the living conditions of African Americans in the city. In it was a passage, quote, "There are people who think that the Negro is in the same environment that the white man is, since we live in the same city side by side. This was not the case," close quote. Reverend Gordon had been born in Pulaski, Tennessee, the birthplace of the Ku Klux Klan. He had been trained both in ministry, in psychology, and sociology. He moved to South Bend in the 1920s and often used his book to sound a strong warning against the growing racism he observed in whites. He said, quote, "Public sentiment has been built up against Negroes coming into certain localities," close quote. He had the view that while legislation against discrimination was important and critical, legislation alone was ineffective in combating racism. A change must take place in public sentiment, a change within the hearts of people. He experienced this himself firsthand. Olivet AME Church had just become an independent church, the first African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church. It was located at 801 North Eddy Street in a white neighborhood. During the time the church was under construction, the Ku Klux Klan showed up late one night and damaged the building. After that incident, the church members kept all-night vigils in order to prevent further damage. There was resistance in the form of the KKK. There was also resistance in the form of public sentiment fiercely opposed to African Americans owning homes in certain parts of the city. One of the chief weapons in the battle to keep neighborhoods white was the racially restrictive covenants.
So on top of the redlining, we also had racial covenants, right? So these were things written into deeds saying that you could not sell your house to African Americans.
That's Judith Fox. She is a national expert on foreclosure, predatory lending, and fair housing.
And we still have those in our community. They're not enforceable, but first of all, they were enforceable years ago. They haven't been enforceable, you know, for more than 50 years, but people don't know that they're not enforceable sometimes. And certain neighbor, like I know, for instance, the Sunnymead neighborhood have restrictions that you can't have you can't sell to an African-American. An African-American can't live in the house unless they're a servant, right? Now, again, it's no longer enforceable, but for many years they were, right? So you have this entire community that was prevented from really accessing the markets to buy their homes until well into the 60s and 70s and even beyond. I mean, I have spoken to folks in South Bend who tried to get home loans, you know, into the 70s and couldn't. And there's a marvelous project in Minneapolis called Mapping Discrimination. And they've been able to document that racial covenants were being put into deeds long after they were illegal or unenforceable. They're not technically illegal, it's just you can't enforce them. So I think you have to look at the generational problem of people being unable to access those markets.
Even the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA, participated in this discrimination. Its official manual declared, if the neighborhood is to remain stable, it is necessary that property shall continue to be occupied by the same social and racial classes. In the view of realtors, banks, the FHA, and the public at large, harmonious neighborhoods was another name for racially and economically segregated neighborhoods. The families of the Better Homes Co-op wanted to find homes away from the factories and slums that surrounded them. They wanted to give their children a better start in life than they had. This was the reason their families had moved to the north in the first place. I'm the youngest of five kids. I have two brothers, two sisters. A part of the curse of being the youngest is that so many things happened before I was born. In that way, I was perpetually clueless. I grew up in the 1200 block of North Olive Street in South Bend as the youngest. We moved from a house on Sample Street into a home owned by attorney Charles Wills when I was about 2 years old. The story I was always told was that he had sold his home to my parents in anticipation of relocating for a new job. I recall my parents saying that he had been offered a job overseas, which required a physical exam. During the exam, he found out he had a heart condition, and that prevented him from being able to handle the demands of the new position. By this time, our parents had given up their home on Sample and Olive Street was the only option. We lived with attorney Wills and his wife for about 6 months until he was able to find a new home. I grew up hearing stories about how he and his wife spoiled me. Being a toddler, they doted on me and were constant figures in my life even after their move. Similar to attorney Allen, attorney Wills had a great civil rights record challenging racial discrimination and injustice. He would go on to be lead attorney in the effort to desegregate South Bend schools. I went to elementary school at Cayley. Most of my friends from the neighborhood either went to Cayley or Marquette. Most of my white friends in the neighborhood who were Catholic went to Holy Cross, located across from Measle Grove Park. I remember one day when I was 5 or 6 years old, I was tagging along with my brother Daniel. He was the best. He owned the big brother thing. My oldest brother, Donald, did not have that level of patience with me, and that was totally understandable. I was the geek younger brother who read encyclopedias. Daniel was on his way to visit some of his friends. Along the way, I asked more than once where we were going, It was the first time I can recall hearing Elmer Street as a destination. It was the two blocks of homes owned by the families of Better Homes of South Bend. My memories are distinct. Elmer Street had manicured lawns. Everywhere you turned, there were kids playing together. Almost all my brother's friends had little brothers or sisters. And being the youngest, I would sometimes tag along with my sisters, my oldest sister, Sue Catherine, and my other sister, Rita. Their friends also had younger brothers and sisters, and we all came to know each other. Their parents knew our parents. Our parents knew all of their kids. This was different from the mostly white neighborhood we lived in. Everyone was black. The kicker is that at the time, we knew this was special, like an oasis. This was Elmer Street. When I was about 9 years old, I would go door to door selling magazines. It was a rite of passage of sorts. It's what my older brothers had done, my time now. First it was Grit, then it was Boy's Life, but I kind of hit the jackpot when I started selling Jet magazine. Jet was a black magazine, a smaller weekly version of the monthly magazine Ebony. Jet costs 20 cents. I could keep a nickel for every one I sold and send the rest back to the company. My dad and brothers helped me with the process of buying a money order, mailing it back. For me, Elmer Street was my marketplace for a black magazine, and I pretty much made my living on Elmer Street. All of the families were willing to help an aspiring entrepreneur. They were all in the same neighborhood. That was pretty nice. I was making a couple of bucks a week, which was pretty good back in fourth grade. This allowed me to indulge my superhero crush, and Marvel and DC Comics made a chunk of change off of me. That was business. But as you can imagine for us kids, Elmer Street was mostly about fun. Hanging out with your friends, playing football, basketball, exploring the Kirk Concrete quarries a few blocks away, all about fun. As we became teenagers, we had house parties with the girls, all under the watchful eye of parents upstairs. The parties would end early enough for us to get home by 10:30 or 11, and there was never any worry, and we knew that any word of trouble had a way of getting back to our parents faster than the internet. Not to mention that all the adults were like our own parents and checked you if you got out of line. This was Elmer Street. But what was the story? How did Elmer Street happen? The co-op Better Homes of South Bend, Inc. began Sunday afternoon, May 21st, 1950. The paid members of the co-op, Bosie and Lila Williams, Clint and Cleo Taylor, Marcus and Lalar Cecil, Arnold and Loretta Allen, Robert and Louise Taylor, Gus and Josie Watkins, Wade and Butha Fuller, Earl and Bureau Thompson, Bland and Rosa Jackson, John and Millie Fleming, Sherman and Ruby Page, William and Catherine Bingham. When they elected officers, Loretta Allen seemed a natural choice for president. She was a born leader, well-spoken, and she commanded authority. She also knew how to make the right connections with people who could help them, such as their attorney, Chester Allen. She grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, born in Oklahoma, but her family had moved north. She was married to Arnold Allen, who was born near Memphis, Tennessee. His family had moved to Detroit when he was 2 years old. He was a musician who had his own band up until World War II. Vice President Earl Thompson lived in a defense home at 1339 Prairie Avenue. He was born in Newton, Alabama. His family moved to South Bend when Earl was five, joining relatives already here. He worked in the machine shop at Studebaker's and was active in his church at St. John's Missionary Baptist Church. He was a deacon, serving on the deacon board, a senior director of the choir, and part-time church custodian. Secretary Louise Taylor and her husband Robert both lived on Prairie Avenue. They both arrived in South Bend in the early 40s. Robert had a job as a laborer at Studebaker's. The couple had no children. Assistant Secretary Ruby Page was wife of Sherman Page. They lived at 1517 South Catalpa, just east of Prairie Avenue. In 1950, Ruby worked as an aide in St. Joseph Hospital. She later worked for the Urban League and at Reese's Furniture Store. Her husband Sherman had been born in Indianola, Mississippi, moved to South Bend in 1922 with his family. He joined the armed forces in 1943, married Ruby the same year. He was an assembler at Studebaker. The treasurer was Bland Jackson, born in September 1919 in Sunflower, Mississippi, just a few miles north of Sherman Page's hometown, Indianola. He served as a sergeant during World War II and after the war joined his wife in South Bend, where she had moved to be with relatives in his absence. Like Earl Thompson, he worked in the machine shop at Studebaker. Willie Gillespie was from Memphis, leaving the South in 1948. Melody Fleming was from Elkton, Tennessee. John Fleming came from Hopkinsville, Kentucky. Rosie and Albert Warfield were from Arkansas. William Bingham and his wife, Catherine, were both from Jackson, Tennessee.
My name is Francis Keith Bingham. I was born in Jackson, Tennessee in 1948. And in that same year, my parents moved to, my father graduated from college on the GI Bill and moved to South Bend, where he had an aunt who helped him to get a job at Studebaker's. And that's how my family ended up in South Bend. I was about 9 months old when I came to South Bend, so it's the only home I've ever known. And my dad came from a very poor family in a little small town in western Tennessee called Jackson, Tennessee. It's in Madison County, Tennessee. And he was the oldest in his family. And when World War II broke out, he anticipated getting drafted, so he just decided to enlist, and he enlisted in the Navy, spent 4 years in the Navy, and when he was discharged, he used the GI Bill to go to Lane College, a small historically black college in Jackson, Tennessee. Graduated with a degree, and married my mother and my mom, Kathy, and moved to South Bend together.
Clint Taylor was from Baton Rouge and Robert Allen from New Orleans. Bosie Williams came to South Bend from Marjorie, Arkansas. His wife, Lila, from North Carolina. Louis Stafford was from West Virginia, Walter Hubbard from Mississippi, and Aubrey Chambers from Illinois. Wade Fuller was also from Indianola and his wife, Butha, from Union Springs, Alabama. Only James Adams was unaccounted for, but Leroy Cobb was certain that he, too, originally was from the South. Only Ed Coker, Obie Chambers, Louis Stafford did not work at Studebaker. The group became close-knit, ranging in age from 70 to the youngest, Leroy Cobb, being just 20 years old. It's important to note the roles played by women of Better Homes. In her book, Collective Courage, which deals with the history of African-American cooperatives, Jessica Gordon Nimhart stated that African-American women played significant roles, held leadership positions across almost every kind of organization. The women of Better Homes, whether they were officers or members, bore this out. They were active in many of the educational and civic organizations, characteristic of the times, from the Urban League to the NAACP. Better Homes attorney J. Chester Allen was a man with a long list of firsts. He was the first black man on the South Bend City Council as well as on the school board, first black president of St. Joseph County Bar Association, the first African-American state senator from South Bend elected in 1938. He had attended Brown University. From there, he went on to Boston University School of Law. He started his practice in South Bend immediately after arriving. He used any means he could in his struggle for racial justice. He worked through the Urban League, the local chapter of the NAACP, and also aligned himself with progressive whites. He wrote letters and publicized the wrongs he saw, and despite a number of setbacks, he never gave up. One of his first actions in South Bend, fresh out of law school, was to file a complaint against the exclusion of African Americans at the Ingman Public Natatorium. This effort took 19 years, but was ultimately successful. Attorney Allen, he had met his wife Elizabeth at law school. Both of her parents were college graduates, and she attended Talladega. At law school, she lost a couple of years because of tuberculosis, graduating 6 years after her husband. She did join him in South Bend and was one of the first female African-American lawyers in Indiana. Together, they formed the law firm Allen and Allen in 1939. This served as the core of the Better Homes Group. They were united in their mission to break out of the segregated confinement where they were forced to live, all wanting to find homes away from the factories and slums that surrounded them and give their children a better start in life, a better start than they themselves had. The dreams of lovers was alive. Up until that time, Lincoln Way West was an unofficial racial boundary. Only two black families lived north of it. The dentist Guy Curtis and his wife Josephine in the 1100 block of North Elmer Street, and attorney Charles Wills and his wife in the 1200 block of North Olive Street. If Better Homes succeeded on North Elmer Street, its members would be the first African Americans in that middle and working class neighborhood. As I mentioned earlier, ironically, the home that attorney Charles Wills owned became my childhood home when our parents purchased it from him in 1955. Mr. Wills had been offered a job. He and his wife would be relocating. The story always told to me was that he was required to take a physical for the new job. Perhaps he would be working overseas. He decided not to take the job when the results of the physical revealed a heart problem. The obvious dilemma, he had sold the house to my parents. The solution was typically African American and rooted in Southern culture. Both our families would live under the same roof until the Willses purchased a new home. The quarters were tight, as I was told, tight, but manageable. Being a toddler, Mr. and Mrs. Wills spoiled me for the next 6 months. He and his wife remained powerful influences in my life until their passing, and I have never forgotten the smell of the cherry tobacco he used to smoke in his pipe. Elmer Street, the North Side. The story continues right after this break.